There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Live sport, the latest headlines, and top debate.
This is The Grill.
Live from Kickers Sports Bar with Tom Urquhart
on DubaiEye1038.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. Just gone 4 o'clock on your Saturday afternoon. We are coming to you live from Kicker Sports Bar down here at Dubai Sports City. Myself, Chris McCarty, joined today by the former deputy sports editor of Mail Online. It is Matthew Fortune, joined also by the former ESPN online editor, Mark Lomas. We are talking all things sport, and we will be doing so all the way through until after... We will be doing that with an adult beverage in our hand as well. We are on air until 6 o'clock, so for the next 2 hours you can tune in to us. What are we discussing? Well, we've been discussing thus far the ICC Cricket World Cup. It is ongoing. It's day 10, England taking on Bangladesh as I speak. A big thanks to Nick Compton. He joined us in that opening hour. We will hopefully be joined this hour by Owe Shan, a former caretaker UEE cricket coach, a man who represented England in the shorter format as well. We'll also be keeping an eye on the French Open men's semi-final. It's gone to a fifth set over at Roland Garros. Novak Djokovic, number one seed, taking on the number four seed, Dominic Thiem. There's Euro 2020 qualifying to keep an eye on, transfer business as well. There is a spot of golf to discuss. There's the FIFA Women's World Cup to debate as well. And there is the small matter of Khabib Nurmagomedov. He is coming to Abu Dhabi September 7th. And I've got some news on ticket sales on that for you this hour as well. So keep it locked right here. You are listening to us on The Grill, Dubai 103.8.
This is The Grill.
Join the conversation.
Tweet the team at Dubai Eye Sport.
I want to kick off the second hour if I can, gentlemen. It is the FIFA Women's World Cup. June 7th was yesterday. It kicked off yesterday. France 4-0 winners over South Korea. Wendy Renard scoring 2 goals in their victory over South Korea. So the hosts are up and running. 3 matches today in total. Group A will conclude. 1995 champions Norway. They're up against Nigeria. And then it will see two-time winners Germany. They take on China. 1999 runners-up in the opening Group B match. And then Spain taking on South Africa. You messaged me this morning, Mark, to say that you've done a power of reading on the FIFA's Women's World Cup. Women's game, it interests you though, in fairness.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was back in 2011 I went to the first ever Women's Super League match between Arsenal and Chelsea, and that was kind of a turning point, I think, for women's football in England. Getting a little bit of investment, of course, that is about to reach really high new levels now with the investment from Barclays in the Women's Super League that's come in. And I think it's great. You know, back at that match, there was only a few thousand people there. It was at a non-league ground. You know, you wondered how it could kind of take off, but really it hasn't. Part of that is some great investment from the football clubs in the UK, from the Football Association. Not so much from FIFA, I have to say, if I'm being critical. I think it's the individual associations have been the ones who have been ploughing the funds into various women's teams. But the standard, the quality, and has matched the investment, I think, and hopefully that is going to only get better. And England are one of the favourites to win this Women's World Cup. Fantastic form going into the tournament, and looking to build on the third place finish in
United States, they've been powerhouses for a long time. Scandinavia, Norway have been a powerhouse for a long time as well. You worked at Arsenal Football Club. I always think of Arsenal being a bit of a trailblazer when it came to their women's team. Manchester United only launched theirs last year, for goodness sake. Arsenal have been at the top for so long.
Yeah, indeed. And the thing is that it's because there was consistency throughout the club and they were treated very much as their own entity. It wasn't an afterthought. They had their own entrance at the training ground. They had their own full coaching setup. The manager in charge of that, Vic Akers, only had a role as a kit man at Arsenal. So it wasn't a dilution of his powers in any way, shape or form. And there was big, big investment from the club. You had the likes of Faye White there, who was the captain, the England captain at the time. And they did phenomenal outreach within the community.
Who was the Scottish girl? Fleeting.
Karen
Fleeting.
Oh, Julie Fleeting.
Julie
Fleeting, big number 8 in the middle.
Oh.
And they really attracted big, big players in, and the outreach that they did around the community. And when Arsenal moved into the Emirates Stadium, games were given to the ladies in that sense. And as Mark says, that has actually been a blueprint for lots of other individual clubs to do the very same thing. And he's right in that there hasn't necessarily been the support from the very top. But if you look right down at every single level, even the media this season, you cannot move, certainly in England, for lack of wall charts, for information, player profiles, big brands. They had their own kit launches. Everything is being done, which is absolutely perfect to generate that added interest, because there's always been an appetite and an interest in it. And gone are those days now where it's very much an afterthought. This is now the forefront of people's mind throughout a summer where there is no big tournament for anybody who just focuses on men's games. And that has filtered into all of the responses coming from managers. There's that brilliant quote from Pep Guardiola a couple of months ago, in which he was on the day before winning the FA Cup, wasn't it? And he said, you're on the brink of winning the treble for the very first time, domestic treble. And he bit back immediately. First time men's team have done it, the ladies did it last year. And it's that, because everybody has been a part of this discussion and wanted to move it forward, that people then respond to that. And when people who are very narrow-minded about these things see the likes of Pep Guardiola being aware of it, that can only be a beneficial thing.
I am noticing, you're absolutely right to point out all these different things. I am noticing, however, Panini, no sticker book for the Women's World Cup.
However, what I can say, though, is if anybody follows the Twitter account, which is the Cheap Panini,
they are
doing their own money tweeted. Anybody who enjoys just a little bit of comedy on their Twitter feed, obviously follow Chris McCarty 19, but also follow if you follow Cheap Panini stickers,
they're brilliant.
They do fantastic cartoon drawings of famous English players.
We had them on.
Oh, did you?
We had them on. The guys, it's a husband and wife team who are raising money, and they did it. They attempted to draw throughout the duration of last year's men's World Cup. They attempted to draw every single player between the kickoff of the tournament and the end of it, and they succeeded on that. So
and
it's interesting.
The same for the ladies, which I think is absolutely brilliant.
That's brilliant. That's what we need to see, though, right? People are properly engaging.
And I totally agree with what Matt said. That I think that this is going to be a breakthrough tournament, really, for women's football in terms of global appeal. You saw it this season. There were 60,700 people attended a Spanish Primera Division women's game between Atletico Madrid and Barcelona.
Wow.
20,000 people, Champions League final. The Juventus women team played at the Allianz Arena for the first time, at the Allianz Stadium for the first time, and 45,000 people at the Parc des Princes for the opening match of the Women's World Cup last night.
France, because you look at Olympic Lyonnais, they are the head and shoulders above the rest. They've been European champions more times than I can count. I think they've swooped in. They've signed one of Manchester City ladies' key stars for next season as well. You look at their squad, they've got Hegerberg as well. She is the FIFA Women's World Player of the Year. Ada Hegerberg, who's what a player, the Norwegian. And that's the travesty in all of this. She's not playing because she doesn't believe that the Norwegian ladies get enough respect over in Norway, so that's why she's not playing. The world's best player not on the biggest stage.
Yeah, it's really disappointing that she's not coming in. BBC Women's Football of the Year this year, last year's Ballon d'Or, feminine winner, saying that it's because of a lack of respect for women's football in Norway. Norway are actually one of the countries that do offer men's and women's teams parity in terms of what they pay them. Women got 50%. The women's team got 50% increase to bring that level in 2017. But still, I think it's more about the media coverage, the respect that Hegerberg doesn't feel is there. But yeah, you mentioned France. They're getting off to a great start. 4-0 victory. They probably will be among the favourites on home soil. I'd expect them to get at least to the quarterfinals. Maybe go on. But yeah, the Lyon team. The France team that started last night had 7 Lyon players in. They won the treble this year.
Wow.
And all the goals were scored by Lyon players. Eugenie Lassomer, Wendy Renard, you said, with 2, and Amandine Henry as well scored the goals. No relation to Thierry, but her goal was Henry-esque, bent into the top corner last night. Fantastic goal. But yeah, so I think, you know, France were 4th at the 2012 Olympics, 4th at the 2011 World Cup. Lost at 2015 World Cup at quarterfinals to Germany, but they could be among the ones going for it. But I think England, I feel like a broken record here. England for the Cricket World Cup, England for the Women's World Cup.
They're not winning the UEFA Nations League, though. No. We can safely say that.
Let me say this, and I'm more just throwing it out there as a discussion point. Women's football, I do think, needs to be wary, and I don't have all of the stats to hand, but Lyon have won the last 4 Champions Leagues. Yeah. They were in the finals 2 years before that. You just need to make sure that the investment is at an even keel at this stage. I just think, and I don't know if, Mark, you're more well-read on this than I am, but just to make sure that we don't have runaway train teams domestically and then internationally, so churning out the same stuff, because if that starts to happen, I just fear that the lack of interest because of a lack of competition might be a big problem.
So certainly in England, I think the Barclays sponsorship is going to be helping that, because amazingly in the Women's Super League, you have a team like Yeovil Town Ladies, have a ladies team, which is remarkable to think that, you know, a team that's in League One can put a ladies team into elite football. But they've they've struggled really for finance. Getting Barclays on board and getting the sponsorship money, getting perhaps more TV revenue as well, that's going to help, I think, make it more of an even playing field. And Chris, you mentioned that it's an absolute disgrace for Manchester United that it took so long to put the women's team back in there, because they did have a women's team in the 1990s.
But it is interesting what you say there, and you're absolutely right. When a league and certainly interest is just starting out, it's important there is parity. I think we're all in agreement with that. I think that's one of the things that most people gripe about European football today. The money has separated the great from the also-rans, and when I say great, I mean that in terms of the big clubs. West Ham is a wonderful story. I was over there maybe 18 months ago watching them when they were in the second tier, and Jack Sullivan, who's the son of David Sullivan, what is he, 19, 20 years of age, is now the owner of that football club. In order for them to invest, they got to the FA Cup final, did West Ham. Okay, they came a cropper against Manchester City in that final, but it just shows you there's such a talent pool out there that if you can think outside the box, be a bit creative with your recruitment, that you can go places in the women's game.
I think I do agree with that. However, one slight criticism I have of West Ham and Jack Sullivan is that, it, to me, that felt a little bit gimmicky. And it felt a little bit demeaning, I think, to put a 19-year-old in charge of a women's football team who are playing in the Women's Super League.
Vic Akers, you say, was Kitman.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Kitman from the men's team, I mean, I don't know his coaching credentials. Was he a coach of some
of
you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so he was. So for Jack, age is just a number, as we often say. His business acumen, and I read an article, I think it was in The Guardian a few weeks back, saying that what a job he's done. You're absolutely right to say, a bit gimmicky, David Sullivan saying, take the women's team, see how you can get on in business. It's a bit like that, but he's done a great job. You've got to judge him on
that. There was a fly on the wall documentary as well, and that again is, you know,
another idea. I think it was Netflix style, wasn't it? It was a bit like All or Nothing, where they put the cameras in. But again, that's helping grow the league, and the more that we do things, it's going to be outside the box a little bit. Women's game, you know, there is the idea that the horse has bolted with regards to the men's game, but this is an opportunity with the way that social media is to maybe think outside the box to accelerate the level of getting people tuned in to the women's game. And it's interesting you say, Mark, that you're expecting this to be the big tournament, because in 2015, I think it was record numbers, record turnout in the stadiums in Canada, and record people viewing around the world. So that is some statement. So we're expecting even better this year.
Absolutely. I think it's going to take it up a notch. And obviously Scotland are there as well.
Chris. Yeah, we are. Go on, Scotland.
Playing against the old enemy tomorrow in the first game. So it should be an interesting one there.
Oh, I'll be watching that through my cracks in my fingers, that one. But Scotland are there. Scotland have got a number of, Kim Little, I think, is one of the big name stars to keep an eye on from Scotland's perspective. But yeah, looking forward to this Women's World Cup. And we will be in conversation with Emma Dodds during this week. She is over there. She is covering the Women's World Cup, formerly of Dubai 103.8, of course. We will be checking in with her, just getting an idea of what it's like over there in France. And from what we're reading, France have really bought into it. It's like what Canada did 4 years ago, the whole nation buying into it.
I think it's a little bit mixed, actually, from what I've seen. I think, actually, my sister lives in Paris, so I've kind of asked her, has she seen posters? And she said it hasn't really been that much in your face there, which seems a little bit of a shame to me. I think in terms of ticket sales, though, it's looking good. And I think I think the stadiums will be full. There will be a lot of people attending, but I think there's no question that it still hasn't been given quite the same attention in France, media-wise, as the Men's World Cup would have been.
Yeah, well, we've all been to major tournaments, because we were all in Russia last year, and you could feel it the minute you got off the plane, the atmosphere for the World Cup away from the stadiums. I think goes back to the thing we mentioned, or Mark mentioned right at the beginning, is that the individual nations and the media within those nations and the clubs within them are all well behind this, don't get me wrong. But at the very top, there's not that massive of interest. I know, and I've been reading some interesting pieces about it, that packed out stadium, a full-on opening ceremony, everybody interested, everybody keen. But in and around Paris, it just hasn't had that pickup. And there's no reason for it, because everybody externally is really, really interested in it. So you kind of feel that they're really missing a trick here. Going back to the thing we were talking about, Baku, earlier on, Mark says, and we saw, there was an appetite for the game, absolutely, within Baku, on the streets of it. There was a fan park. That's how you do it. And I think they want to... There's no fear that this isn't going to be the biggest World Cup, of course, and there will be big, big steps made forward for it, but it would just be good to see that, people talking about it on the streets, people interested, and FIFA really, really getting behind it.
We will endeavour to ensure that we are keeping a very close eye on the Women's World Cup. It is a huge tournament, takes you all the way through into next month as well, and we will keep an eye, and there's some big teams, some big name players, all the big name players will be there, of course, no doubt about that. Keeping an eye on the tennis, and Lomas keeps flicking a little look over to our big screen here down at Kickers, because has been a break. Dominic Thiem.
Dominic Thiem has had a break in the fifth set, so he's 3-1 up at the moment, and he is looks like he's about to win the fifth game as well. That's going to be 4-1. Massive, massive step, I think, here towards a rematch of last year's final with Rafa Nadal. I still don't think he's going to win the final.
You don't.
No.
Still back
whatever,
Rafa.
Whatever always
back gives
Rafa.
You that idea.
92 wins and 2 losses on clay at Roland Garros,
that's
I think.
Insane, isn't it? But that run needs to come to an end at some point, doesn't it? That's what everyone's been saying. But if Rafa does go on and take success tomorrow in this men's final in the French Open, we're of course talking tennis now, then what a story that is. That moves him on to 18 within 2 of Roger. I mean, this is the debate that never ends. There's no right or wrong answer to it. Robbie Greenfield and I have had this debate many a time, both on air, off air. He is very much of the opinion that Novak will one day usurp them both. If Novak doesn't get past Dominic here, he stays on, what's he on, 16?
I think 15, so.
15. 15, 15. No, 16. He's on 16. Rafa moves on to 18, and then Roger on 20. Benji's a big tennis fan. He's saying he's on 15. Yeah, thanks, Benji. So he's on 15. So he's still got 5 to match Roger. He's got 6 to usurp him, which I think is a tall order. If Rafa, though, wins tomorrow, he moves to within 2. If those knees hold up, he's the man that Roger should fear.
Well, it's just, it's Roland Garros, isn't it? Every year he can come there and play, and if he is fit, he will be the favourite. And I can't see that changing even in the next few years, even as Rafa gets into his late 30s. You know, he's just such a dominant player on clay, and particularly the clay of Roland Garros. It's absolutely amazing. I mean, the performance against Federer yesterday, you know, Federer hasn't dropped a set, one set in the tournament so far. And to sweep him away in straight sets, only David Goffin has won a set against Nadal at this year's tournament. We've talked about the record. You know, he hasn't lost there since losing to Djokovic in the quarterfinals in 2015. So
it's amazing when you watch him, because yesterday, and I sat through the whole match, and obviously, you know, again, I make no apologies for this, I'm rooting for Roger in the match, but you just look, he just couldn't hit through him. The only man that I've ever seen hit through Rafa at Roland Garros is Robin Soderling, the man that went to the final that year, and of course Roger, that gave Roger the opportunity to win his only French Open. The only other man that has beaten Rafa at Roland Garros is Novak Djokovic, but of course he was in his purple patch where he was doing what Rafa has done to so many, and that's just run and run, make no unforced errors and force the errors on the other wing. Other than that, I mean, Roger yesterday, he looked average, and we're talking about the maestro here. There was an opportunity at 4-all in the second set. He was 40 love up, was Roger, on his own serve, and Rafa would come through and win the next 5 points and win it. And actually, if I had to take a 5-4 lead, he would see out that second set, and from there was only ever going to be one winner. Could never consistently get in a rhythm whereby he was hitting through Rafa.
But I love this idea as well, that Nadal almost plays better in those windy conditions.
Yeah.
He grew up in Mallorca, where it's blustery around the island, and you know, bringing that into play in the match against Federer yesterday. But interesting you say Soderling. I was reading some quotes from him. He was asked, like, what did you do and how can you stop Rafa? He said, you have to play extremely well, which I think is a little bit of an understatement, to be honest. But no, he went on to say, to beat him on clay, the only chance is for a player to be aggressive,
yeah,
take some risks. And that was the same, exactly as you said, with Nadal. He was also with Djokovic. He was asked how he beat Nadal, and it was mix up the pace, get into the net, drop shots, high balls, you know, be unpredictable and be aggressive. But it's so hard because Nadal is the one who dictates the play, and he just gets to everything
as
well.
It's that huge lefty topspin that he gets on that forehand of his. But I still stick by it, and the more I think about it, in actual fact, that Robin Soderling performance against Rafa Nadal all those years back, probably one of the single greatest singles performances ever, for the reason that he was fit, Rafa. Okay, he was young and he was dealing with pressure, young age, you're still maturing. But for Robin to consistently hit through Rafa, and I'm remembering it now, it was astonishing. He was just taking the ball early and slamming it with huge power, and he was hitting through Rafa. Incredible.
And even more amazing was, I think 2 weeks before, either in Monte Carlo or Madrid, he lost 6-love, 6-1 against Nadal in the final.
I mean, it's
absolutely battered, and then came up with that absolutely remarkable performance.
Such a sad story, Robin Soderling. He does those. Yeah. He got glandular fever, I think it was, and could never make a comeback. I saw him in Dubai a couple of years back, and he looked an absolute shadow of his former self. We wish Robin Soderling all the very best as he moves on, of course, in his career, whatever that may be now. But there's no doubt that that was one of the performances I've ever seen from an individual. Goran Ivanišević beating Patrick Rafter as well in that Wimbledon final as well. Let us know your thoughts. 4001. We're keeping an eye on that semi-final. It does indeed look as if Dominic Thiem will be booking his place in tomorrow's final. Still plenty more to come on Dubai 103.8. You are listening to The Grill. We're coming to you live from Kickers.
This is The Grill, live from Kickers Sports Bar, where the game is always on.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. We were just talking there. Thank you very much. We were just talking there about the fact that the rains, the heavens have opened over in the French capital, just as it looked as if Novak Djokovic was heading out. He may have just been saved, Lomas.
Yeah, the rain is pouring down now at Roland Garros, and it's Dominic Thiem is 4-1 up in the fifth set. It's deuce. So it's quite a useful time, I think, for Novak Djokovic to try and regain some composure and regain his thoughts. But I don't know. I think too much now with Thiem having two breaks in the final set.
Has he got two breaks? Has he? So if Novak's serving, that makes it 4-2. No, it's only one break. One break? We're working it out. I think it's only the one break. If Novak takes it, it's 4-2. If he then breaks Dominic, it's 4-3. It's back on serve. It's just the one break. So, I tell you what, don't rule out Novak Djokovic.
The weather helping him out again.
Yeah, the weather conditions might just help him. We'll keep an eye on that one. But the heavens have opened over in the French capital. Roland Garros is the venue. We'll keep an eye on that one. So that does mean, as you rightly pointed out, the women's final has been pushed back a little further. An awful lot written on social media about the fact that the women's game has had to play second fiddle to the men's game over the last couple of days because Joanna Konta was forced off of her court onto one of the back courts, the third court, yesterday. She was up in arms about it, saying that it lacked respect. And then again today, and I know an awful lot of journos have been having their say on this, why did Novak and Dominic not follow the women's final? Give them the grandioso, give them the big build-up, get that final done and dusted, and then roll out the men again.
Totally agree. Why? And you know, we've seen the CEO of the WTA has said that as well. You know, there's no respect being shown to women's tennis, and it's not being put on an equal playing field. You know, the women's final should be the pièce de résistance of the Saturday, and exactly as you said, the men's final should the men's semi-final should continue afterwards. But yeah, exactly as you mentioned, Konta, in fact I think both semi-finals were shunted onto alternative courts, both of the women's semi-finals, and Konta spoke afterwards about how disappointing it was. She's played in semi-finals at the Aussie Open in the Rod Laver Arena. She's played at Centre Court Wimbledon in the 2017 semi-finals to raucous packed crowds, and here she was moved to the Court Simone Mathieu, barely half full, for a 5,000 arena. Really disappointing. It was exactly the same for the second semi-final as well, Barty versus Anisimova. It was quite empty. So it's poor, I think. It's poor, but then you understand kind of why they have to do that. In terms of putting the men on first, the idea is to get them out of the way so they have more time to rest for the final, but maybe put it on a different court. You know, they shunted the women to the second court.
Absolutely.
Why not put the men on a different court and sell those tickets, because they sold the tickets separately for the men's and the women's.
It's a very simple perception game. As we were talking about with Women's World Cup football, it's the perception of, even if it's a perception of interest, if you look at the UK media before this Women's World Cup, even if you knew nothing about it, but you're seeing every single newspaper, every single TV channel with previews, with wall charts, with player profiles, social media going mad for it. I know the FA are fully behind it. There isn't a separate account for the England ladies. There's one for, it comes out of the same FA account.
Brilliant.
The perception of it, even if nobody cared, the perception that everybody cared would drive all the more interest. How can women expect to be taken as seriously as they fully deserve to be if they're not given that respect by their own organising committee? I think it's a shambles.
It is a shambles, and there will be those that point out they are on an equal footing from a prize money perspective. That old age-old debate continues about whether women should step up to five sets. Then we get into a popularity and all the rest of it, but it's a fascinating one, this, and to just kind of weigh in on it. The error that the French Open officials made was yesterday that I get, and I'm with you on this, Lomas, Novak Djokovic, for me, he set the agenda. He was the first one to walk off when he was broken at 3-1 in that third set against Dominic Thiem. He said, I'm had enough of this. The rain was coming in. It was light drizzle. Eventually, the umpire, Dominic Thiem, went off as well. There was a window where the sunshine came out in the evening. There was an hour. There was enough time, and I'm going on the journals that are over there in Paris who said, wait a minute, why on earth are we closed shop for the day? Why are we at a point now where they wouldn't do that at Wimbledon, even if it was Roger and Serena Williams? You sit there until 9 o'clock, half past nine, 10 o'clock, until we see that there is no sun, and even then they put the roof on and turn the lights on.
you stay there. There's none of this you dictating to us. It just seemed a bit odd yesterday.
There were, and exactly as you said, you know, you saw on social media the pictures of blue sky above the arena like an hour after the match has been postponed. But
my favourite one was journalist Stuart Fraser tweeted saying, "Nice evening to pick up a tan in an empty stadium." And it's absolutely right, but that just shows absolute weakness. And Konta was saying about the court change, she wasn't consulted about it. Again, shows massive weakness from the organising committee. It's almost like they're too scared because they knew they were doing something wrong there, in the same way that they knew to try and argue with Novak was going to be a big ask, but they need to have that sort of authority, and they've shown that they can have roughshod run over them by these guys. It's terrible.
Won't be a problem from next year though, because they think that the roof is going to be
built
in place for next year's French Open.
Are they looking to get that built on for next year? Interesting. Watch the space on that front, but we'll keep an eye on Roland Garros. Do let us know your thoughts on that. Listen, I appreciate there is it's difficult. I mean, I say there's no right or wrong answer. In this instance, there is. Just shunt Novak and Dominic onto another court and get the women's final started. Tennis fans, though, let us know your thoughts. And I know many of you out there that love your tennis that will want to weigh in on that particular conversation. Please do. You can do that. 4001. You can also pick up the phone. 04871 5500. We await then Ashleigh Barty taking on Markéta Vondrousova, the young teen from the Czech Republic, unseeded as well. Another remarkable story. Yelena Ostapenko did it. She was unseeded from Latvia a couple of years back. And we've got another instance here. Why does it seem it's always the French Open? Is clay the kind of leveller?
That's exactly what it is, I think. You know, it's quite the opposite from the men's game, where we've seen Nadal just absolutely dominant. But clay is an unpredictable surface, and French Open has traditionally over the years thrown up some unpredictable Grand Slam winners. And we've seen four times, this will be the fourth time in 4 years that we've had a new first-time Grand Slam champion, after Gabriel Muguruza, Ostapenko, and then Simone Halep, of course, winning her first Grand Slam last year. But yeah, it's an interesting final, I think. Vondrousova aiming to be the first teenage champion since Iva Majoli upset Martina Hingis in 1997. So, but yeah, it was an interesting one, her semi-final, because she was 5-0 up in 12 minutes in her semi-final, but then lost six games in a row. It was an incredibly topsy-turvy semi-final, but she's...
Talk about nerves.
Yeah. But she's in there, you know, exactly as you said, 19 years old. Ashleigh Barty, though, is seeded, and she is firmly the favourite for this one. We were talking off air before. Great, interesting fact about Ashleigh Barty is that she quit tennis for 2 years back in 2014 and became a cricketer, a professional cricketer in Australia. So she made her debut for Brisbane Heat in the Women's Big Bash.
Love it.
In 2015, hitting 39 off 27 balls with 1-6.
I love it.
And then she's decided to come back to tennis after taking a break. But
it's a bit like yourself, Matt. It's from boxing to Iron Man, back to boxing. That's the plan, isn't it? You're a dual sportsman these days.
I'm not sure I'm representing anybody other than myself anytime soon, though. So not quite the same, but I appreciate it.
But I admired that. I've read a couple of interviews with Ashleigh Barty, and she said that, having, you know, grown up quite quickly as a teenage tennis player, you have to travel the world a lot, you have to play, and she said, "I wanted to experience life as a normal teenage girl and have some normal experiences." I don't know about playing in the Women's Big Bash as a normal experience for a teenager,
I guess, she's able to stay in our family house and live life not on the road, because I think that's one thing that we take for granted. And I appreciate, listen, being a top sportsman or woman, it's my dream, I'm sure it was your dream growing up, but for a tennis player to be on the road as much as they are, I mean, you get a little bit of an insight here when they're over for the Dubai Duty Free Tennis Championship, and you sit year on year and talk to them, and the first thing they say is, "Love this tournament. Why do you love this tournament?" It isn't so much us, the fans, or us, the media. No, it's because the hotel is right there on their doorstep. It means that they can get a little bit more free time, because they're not travelling. And you get a real insight into, like, my goodness, for 9-10, and look at the tennis calendar now, it's a 12-month rolling tour. They've never got time. They're always living out of suitcases. It's bonkers like that.
Absolutely, and you remember as well that, you know, a lot of these players, from particularly in the women's game, they tend to break through a little bit younger. So we're seeing players who are like 16, 17, 18, travelling around the world, exactly as you said, away from home, away from that kind of security net. It's quite a lot to take, you know, entering professional sport at that age. So as I said, I really admire the decision and the wherewithal to think, actually, let's take a couple of years off. And, you know, she's here, Grand Slam final, and she's still only 23.
I moved to Abu Dhabi in 2010. I was 23 and I cried my eyes out for about 3 weeks. So what these girls and guys are doing at 16 traveling the world, more power to them. Keep it locked right here where you are listening to The Grill. We've got much more to discuss between now and 6 o'clock. We're going to be joined by Sean O'Shea in about half an hour time. He is the first team coach of AIK Stockholm. We're also going to be joined, I'm excited about this, by Declan Taylor. He is boxing correspondent. He was over there as we were. We need to talk about that as well a little bit. AJ defeated last week by Ruiz Jr. Andy Ruiz Jr. will be discussing that much, much more between now and six. Stay tuned.
This is The Grill, live from Kickers Sports Bar, where the game is always on.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. Day 10 of the ICC Cricket World Cup. It is England taking on Bangladesh. Afghanistan have started their match against New Zealand as well. Let's just give you a quick score update. England currently 296 for three. They are about to post a huge total for Bangladesh to chase. I can tell you that Jason Roy is the man who has done most of the damage. 153 from just 21 balls faced. Sorry, Johnny Bairstow, 51, so he reached his half century. Joe Root, just 21 for Root. And at the crease at this moment in time, it's two men who can accelerate the run rate in the blink of an eye. Joss Butler, he's 47 not out from 30 balls faced. He is ably supported by the skipper, Owen Morgan. He's 16 from 20 balls faced. So England, 296 for three. They're into the final eight overs on that one. We are still awaiting a conclusion to the French Open second semi-final. Rain has brought the players off, not for the first time, between Novak Djokovic and Dominic Thiem. If you are just joining us, the big news in that one is that it's gone to a fifth set. Rain, the heavens have opened. Dominic Thiem, though, leads by 4-1. It will be juice when those two men reappear. There's the women's final a little later as well. There's three matches from the FIFA Women's World Cup. That kicked off yesterday over in France. We'll keep an eye on that as well. There is also the small matter of the UEFA Nations League final. That's tomorrow. Third place playoff as well between England and Switzerland. I will be previewing that with the boys in about 10 minutes' time or so. One thing I'm conscious that we haven't discussed, gentlemen, that I am keen to discuss, and I'm joined by Matt Fortune and Mark Lomas, two sporting journalists, two men, fine, I guess, auditors and fine writers as well, in all honesty. I've read many of the pieces that you boys have done, very good at what they do. One thing we haven't discussed is Eden Hazard. News yesterday that he's off to Real Madrid. Boyhood hero of Eden's is Zinedine Zidane. Boyhood club was Real Madrid of Eden's. Made sense. I think it was always when, not if. He's gone for Real Madrid, 28 years of age, 150 million if all of the add-ons are met. Good deal.
Sorry, can I just nip that in the bud? Can we stop doing the whole add-ons things? That's such a new tabloid thing of doing. It's an £88 million transfer. Can we deal,
I'm led to believe,
as we were a few years ago, I'm, we were dealing in what the cost is at transfer, that, not the five-year contract.
Well, the add-ons are pretty easy to tick off, is what I'm reading today, that Chelsea could well be banking.
Does he have to play for Belgium in that time?
He may well have to have, like, what is it in Football Manager? You need like 15 goals and he gets a bonus and the club gets some extra money as well. But it's a huge deal nonetheless for a 28-year-old.
I mean, he is in that bracket just a little bit under the big two that we still can't get away from, a little bit like we're talking with Rafa in at the French Open, yeah, and Roger and Novak. There's just that little barrier underneath that is such a difficult ceiling to get through. But Eden Hazard has every single credential needed to be there. I would argue that he is the only player like Lionel Messi with that low centre of gravity who can just drift by. You know, you have your big powers, you have your Cristiano Ronaldo's, your Gareth Bale's, those big powerful runners, those athletes. You have this guy, Eden Hazard, who is just such a phenomenal but at the same time beautiful player to watch. The way he moves across the ground, I think he is going to be a big, big star at that football club. If he can get a team around him that suits his style, that will allow him to play with the freedom that he has done at Chelsea, because obviously Real Madrid is a much, much bigger club than Chelsea, but I think the way he plays, the way he moves, the kind of magic that he has in his boots, I think will really endear him to the crowd, and that's half the battle. That's what they need. They need someone with that little sprinkling of magic. Not, you know, Luka Modric has it, but in a very different way. Cristiano Ronaldo had it, but in a very different way. Someone like this who will take on players, who almost humiliate defenders, leave them on their backside, I think he will be a big, big star for them.
Interesting stat for you as well. Eden Hazard, he leaves the English Premier League having created, find this interesting, so stats and more stats, you can find a stat anywhere these days, but he leaves the English Premier League having created a record 595 chances. That's 29 more than any other player in league history. Man City's David Silva, he's second with 566. Interesting as well, as this tweet is pointing out, that Silva joined the league two seasons before Eden Hazard. Now, chances created are one thing. One thing that I've often levelled against Eden Hazard is his output perhaps isn't as good as it should be from an assist point of view and a goals point of view, because if you look in history, He has his peaks and his troughs. He has one season, goes cold for a season. Has a great season, goes cold for a season. So Real Madrid are spending huge money on him to be the top dog. That was what was missing last season. No Ronaldo. Vinicius was out, in and out. Gareth Bale had his injury problems. Karim Benzema, for goodness sake, ended up being Real Madrid's top performer last season. Eden Hazard, huge pressure on him. Will he succeed?
Yeah, I mean, I've watched Eden Hazard play a lot of Chelsea, and I think he is one of those players who genuinely brings excitement. He's fearless on the ball, exactly as Matt said before. He loves taking players on. He's an exceptional footballer, and he is probably just underneath that level. But you know, playing with someone like Zidane, there are similarities, a myriad similarities, I think, between Zidane and Hazard. I think playing for him will bring the best out of him. I think it's interesting that he says he's a boyhood Real Madrid fan. Isn't everyone who signs for Real Madrid a boyhood Real Madrid fan?
Yeah.
That's how it goes, isn't it?
Yeah, but, absolutely right.
I do think that you mentioned that he's 28 years old, and you know, we saw when Real Madrid invested in Cristiano Ronaldo, they bought him at 24, I think.
Yeah.
I do think it's a couple of years too late. I think he should have made that move for himself. I think he should have made that move a couple of years ago. He is still an impact, you know, he does still have a tremendous impact. We've seen that in the Premier League this year. He's basically almost single-handedly carried Chelsea. You know, you speak to Chelsea fans, if Hazard wasn't in that team, they would have been nothing this season. They would have been nowhere. So he's still carrying that Chelsea team. And yes, you know, he's had peaks and troughs, but I think he's an exceptional talent. I do wish for him that he'd gone a couple of years earlier, because I think he would have been really pushing the best players in the world then. But I think he will have better players around him at Real Madrid. Hopefully he can shine even brighter there.
Yeah, Mark's absolutely right. Actually, what has he done to move forward as a player in those last 2 years? And this is a big chance for him. He needs to hit the ground running. He needs to make sure that this isn't one of his trough seasons, mostly because of the unforgiving crowd there, because if you start badly, you're in big, big trouble. I think Mark's right. Actually, I didn't think of that 2 years ago it would have been a bigger opportunity for him to break through into that next bracket. And he's now at the club in which he can do that. If you look at other players, you look at Neymar, you look at Kylian Mbappe, those players that we kind of thought would break through that mold, would become the next big thing, or the next biggest thing, should I say. Neither of those two players are now at a club in which they're able to do that. But Eden Hazard is at the club. He is the golden boy at the golden club, really, for it. I think it's going to be a good one to watch.
Yeah, the money that Real Madrid are spending, because when you actually look back in the last few years, Florentino Perez, the Real Madrid president, hasn't spent as much money. Obviously they won 3 European Cups, but that was done so on a bit of a shoestring. That was done on the brilliance of Cristiano Ronaldo and others, Luka Modric at the peak of his power, Sergio Ramos. You look at what they've spent. Luka Jovic, the young Serb, has come in from Eintracht Frankfurt for 62 million. He is someone that will get goals. Interesting to read over in Spain that the plan is to put him in tandem with Karim Benzema. That doesn't seem right to me, but hey ho. They've brought in Eden Hazard, they've brought in Militao, the young Brazilian defender from FC Porto. Ferland Mendy is about to undergo a second medical because they're unsure of a hip injury, that the young French left back, who's had a wonderful season for Lyon and has had a wonderful couple of seasons over in Ligue 1. There's still talk of Paul Pogba, still talk of Christian Eriksen as well. So they're about to go through a huge transitional period, and one thing I want to ask is, where does this leave Gareth Bale? Because you saw it. Zinedine Zidane refused to bring him on against Real Betis. Final game of the season. Didn't give him his farewell. Wants rid of him. Basically said so, and not in so many words, to the Spanish press. Gareth Bale, through his agent, saying, I'm not going anywhere. I've got 3 years. I'll happily be paid to play and sit and play golf around Spain and around Madrid. So where does that leave the Welshman?
Well, I hope he's got a comfy pair of boxer shorts, because he's going to be sitting on the substitutes bench for most of the next couple of seasons.
I mean, where does he go? Who takes a punt?
I think it's an interesting one when these situations happen, when players are on, you know, we talk about Alexis Sanchez as well, players who are on bumper contracts but not playing regularly. I think there has to be at some point the player has to look at themselves and say, what do I want to do with my career? What do I want to achieve? Do I want to sit out a massive contract, earn loads of money and not play for Real Madrid? Or do I want to move somewhere else, and will I take a pay cut to move somewhere else so that I can play football and play regularly, you know? And I think it does, a certain amount of that comes down to the character of the player, and it's about whether, I think, Gareth Bale wants to...
Because United would have bought him.
Yep.
Now, from what we're led to believe, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, I know you're sceptical of this, but Dan James coming in from Swansea, young Welshman, 21 years of age, at the other end of his career to Gareth Bale. Let's be frank, what's Bale now, 30? He's 29 or 30. He's had his injury problems. where on earth does he go? We've talked about this. Tottenham would seem an obvious one if he is willing to take the pay cut, head back to a club that's on the up, but then he's not a Pochettino player.
That's a big pay cut, though. There's a difference between dropping down to Spurs than it would be dropping to Manchester United.
Yeah, but Kane's now on, what, 150?
Yeah, but Gareth Bale's pulling in about 450 grand, yeah, I think.
Yeah, 250,000 pay cut's a big one.
After tax, isn't it, as well?
Indeed.
It's a big one.
The problem is with Gareth, actually, the thing that's holding Gareth Bale back from more game time is, unfortunately, Gareth Bale and those dodgy hamstrings. He hasn't churned out more than about 30 games for Madrid in the last few years, and that's a shame for him because, again, going back to what we were discussing before, that next bracket of players that we really thought would kick on, of course, scored the wonderful goals against Liverpool in the Champions League final. Is a big game player. He's proved it throughout his career. But I don't think there's a market for him in England because of the injuries. That's the big problem. I think the kind of place that he would look to shine would be Italy. That sort of pace, I think, that he would really get at defenders, terrify them. I know it was a long time ago, but of course, famed for tormenting the... it was Maicon, wasn't it? Taxi for Maicon. That was the game that really announced him. Strangely, such an Arsenal thing to say. Spurs actually lost that day, but that's by the by.
They lost 4-3.
Yeah, but let's not, you know, that, how very petty of me. But that's the exact question is, where does he go? I think... he should have enough about him. At the age of 29, he's still, despite being an explosive player, he's still a big, powerful guy. He might lose that pace, but in the same way Cristiano Ronaldo's pace is nowhere near what it used to be. Didn't stop him scoring a hat-trick the other day. Doesn't stop him still scoring goals, being a lot smarter with how he plays. And if Gareth manages his body properly and becomes maybe a little bit more of a centre-forward, knows when to make those runs, exactly as Cristiano Ronaldo's. What's that great stat from the World Cup? The two players that ran the least in the World Cup were Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo. It's because they're smart with how they manage their bodies and the impacts they have. If Gareth can do that in a league a little bit like Italy, that's maybe a little bit slower, not reliant on his pace quite as much, I still think he's got a few years left in the tank.
Who goes for him? I look at the clubs, I go down the list, and I think Chelsea are going to have a transfer ban. Spurs will rule them out because he'd have to take a £250,000 a week pay cut. He's not doing that, for goodness sake. No chance. I wouldn't even do that. Then you look down, you look at Man United, not now. You look at an Arsenal, no chance. Pep Guardiola's not touching him. Liverpool wouldn't touch him. Italy, really? Are they spending 80 million to bring it? I just don't see it. PSG, I don't see it. Where does that leave Gareth Bale?
I think Matt's hit the nail on the head as well in terms of Bale being kind of injury prone as well. So you're taking a gamble, you're taking a punt on a player who is unquestionably talented, but then just looking at a stat, comparing to Eden Hazard. So Eden Hazard, the only attacking midfielder or forward in Premier League history to play in seven or more seasons and make at least 30 appearances in every campaign. So they're getting in Hazard, a robust player who does not get injured very much at all. And Bale is the opposite of that. You know, we see unquestionable talent, but injury prone. So how do you get the most out of that, and is it too much of a risk?
And not only that, but Real Madrid would ask for the stupid fee. Phil Barnett would ask for the stupid money from Gareth Bale's agent. Would ask for the stupid money. Jonathan Barnett, sorry, would ask for the stupid money from a salary perspective. Not worth the punt.
But I think Manchester United. But again, you know, talk about coming a bit late. I feel like Manchester United 2 years ago could have been in there for Gareth Bale, and he probably could have done a great job. But you know, perhaps you are looking at Inter Milan, Juventus, willing to splash a little bit more money into Milan maybe as an option. But
is this not a crying shame? This guy's 29 years old. I mean, he's 4 years younger than me, and we're talking about, oh, he's got nowhere to go. What an absolute travesty.
Your hamstrings are better than that.
Well, I'm not going to be crying too much. He is on £400,000 a week.
But that, to me, and this is maybe a wider discussion, that's career mismanagement.
Yeah,
to my mind, if you are... The problem is he signed that deal when his star was at its highest at Madrid. He'd scored goals against Atletico Madrid in the Champions League final, yeah. And he won that, and he'd had such a positive start at the club. But you price yourself out of a future career. He may say that he's happy warming the bench. I just don't think if you're...
yourself out, he can still take that.
No, of course he can, but that's... Look, yes, I would take a pay cut from 450 grand to 250 grand, fine. But still, when your lifestyle is facilitated... Yeah. Sorry, you have a lifestyle facilitated by that massive salary, it's a lot to ask, regardless of the numbers involved. And I just think it's a real shame to see someone kind of drifting out of the game, essentially. Are we going to see him retiring at 32, 33? What a real waste, and what a sad time for him that is.
Maybe on the European Tour in 2022.
Maybe, just maybe.
He is a good golfer, isn't he?
He is a very good golfer.
Well, they call him that, don't they? They call him the golfer.
Yeah, and I don't think that sat well with him either. There was Thibaut Courtois, it was that releasing was it, the yeah. fact that he's a bit of a low owner. Whenever we go out for late dinners, of course, the Spanish way, he's never there.
He's at home with his Welsh rarebit. You know, tucking in.
He's tucking into his Welsh rarebit with the wife and the young kids, each to their own and all. But yeah, Gareth Bale's future is going to be an interesting one this summer, no doubt about it. So Eden Hazard, we're in kind of the universal opinion is that he will be a success.
I think so. Yeah, yeah, I think it's a great move, and I think he is a wonderful, wonderful football player. And I hope for him that it can take him to that next level.
I also think it's a great move for all concerned. Of course, it's good for Madrid. Of course, it's good for Eden Hazard. I also think it's quite interesting for Chelsea. I'm not saying it's necessarily the best thing in the world to get rid of a player. I think it's interesting for Chelsea. They're going into a market where they don't have that money to spend, but we hear so much about Chelsea's youth team, younger players to say. Of course, Callum Hudson-Odoi finally got his chance, but they have got good players coming back. They've got players out on loan that have done fabulous things in the Championship last season. You look at Tammy Abraham, you look at Mason Mount. They've got players. You look at even Kurt Zouma. This transfer ban is obviously a problem, don't get me wrong. They do have an owner that's maybe a little bit less interested and certainly not pumping the club full of cash that he was previously. But from a Chelsea perspective, when you look at how Manchester City are built and moving forward constantly, and how Liverpool have built house in order moving forward, you're kind of looking at those teams, the Arsenals, Manchester United, Tottenham and Chelsea, for a project, for something for the fans to get behind, because no fan realistically of those four clubs is looking at next season thinking, oh, you know, we've got a chance of winning the title here, because you really don't. So what you're looking for is something else to grab onto. And so for Chelsea, if you're looking at young players coming through, which you haven't had for such a long time, it gives that reinvigoration to the fan base that, okay, we're not going to win the titles, but let's be interesting, let's be good, let's have a nice story around it and get behind individuals.
You're right to point that out, in the sense that Christian Pulisic, the American international, he's already signed. He'll be joining from Borussia Dortmund. Lovely little player. Was actually overshadowed somewhat last season by Jadon Sancho's emergence at Borussia Dortmund. But Christian Pulisic coming in is a like-for-like for Eden Hazard. Tore André Flo, who I was interested to read today,
He's
the loan manager at Chelsea Football Club.
I enjoy that job title, loan coach. What does he do? Go and do separate trainings all around Europe.
And you know the best thing about it as well? I also read today that Shola Amiobi, the Newcastle legend, quote-unquote, he's taking on the same role at Newcastle United, which is loan manager. Anyway, Tore-André Flo is the loan manager. Interested to read, and you've said a few of the names there, because he was talking about if the transfer ban, and I know Chelsea have appealed to CAS, the Court of Arbitration of Sport, on this transfer ban that's been handed down by FIFA, which will necessitate this summer transfer window, January, before they can sign another player the following summer. And Tore-André Flo was pointing out some of the names you mentioned. Tammy Abraham, he's coming back from Aston Villa. Reece James, who in actual fact suffered a suspected broken ankle last night, representing England over at the Toulon, the England under-20s, which is a crying shame, because he was wonderful for Wigan. He was attracting interest from a number of Premier League clubs. Mason Mount, who was wonderful for Derby. You've got Fikayo Tomori, who I know is hugely rated, and I know that Graham Potter at Swansea City, or now Brighton and Hove Albion, huge fan of he was wonderful for Derby last season as well. And Kurt Zouma, who had a wonderful campaign, stayed fit for Marco Silva at Everton. Bring those five players in, bring Christian Pulisic in. We expect Maurizio Sarri to be named Juventus boss next season. You can see where I'm going with this. Frank Lampard comes in, and Jody Morris, who coached all of these players as Chelsea under 18 boss, he is now Frank Lampard's assistant. All of a sudden, when we talk about football today, it's about youthful exuberance, it's about running miles, it's about putting it in, it's about putting joy on people's faces. All of a sudden, this Chelsea team looked quite exciting.
And it's the opposite of what we've thought of Chelsea on for the past 20 years, which is, you know, going out and buying all the best talent from around Europe. Although, you know, they have gone and got this talent at a young age from around Europe, and poached from clubs in England as well. But still, you know, exactly as Matt said, it's great for the fans to get behind. Frank Lampard, you know, speaking to a lot of Chelsea club journalists at the Europa League final, they fully expect Lampard to be the man who comes in. It's a great opportunity because of the transfer ban, his hands are tied a little bit. He will have the forgiveness of the fans. If it doesn't go well, he can point to the fact that they've got a transfer ban. If it does go well, you know, they change the tide a little bit at Chelsea, and they perhaps look a little bit at what life can be like without signing those stupidly expensive players who don't really care about Chelsea, and bringing players up through a youth system, which is what Abramovich, you know, he has invested a lot of money in that youth system at Chelsea. You know, it's in scouting, in the new academy there. You know, he's put a lot of money to that, and we haven't really seen that much come through as yet in the last 20 years.
There was a wonderful tweet yesterday as well. Maurizio Sarri, of course, I found this a bit bizarre, came in for an awful lot of abuse for the way that he looked at his winner's medal at the Europa League. It was the idea that he's never won anything, and this was him admiring this. It was like, oh my goodness, I've finally won a medal. And as someone pointed out on Twitter yesterday, it's quite incredible to think Chelsea fans pointing that out as a stick to beat Maurizio Sarri about with, and yet Frank Lampard celebrating his playoff semi-final win against Leeds United as if Derby had just won the blooming Club World Cup or something of that ilk. But it just shows you that Frank Lampard definitely has an awful lot of goodwill in the bank. He is a Chelsea legend. He's like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, but probably on a bigger scale. He will walk into that job and he will have support from all corners.
Exactly, and also importantly, I think support from Abramovich as well, because he's not just a former Chelsea player. You know, he's stayed on Abramovich's yacht. You know, they're on friendly terms. You know, it's not just a no one. It's a club legend, but also someone with a connection to the owner. Maybe he can convince Abramovich to stick his hand in his pocket again in a year or so's time. But exactly as you say there, you know, Lampard will be afforded time in the same way that Solskjaer has been afforded time by the United fans. Lampard will be afforded time by Chelsea. Sarri, I do think sometimes he doesn't do himself any favours. Like after the Europa League final as well, I dedicate this win to the players who are missing and to the fans of Napoli. That was like one of the first things he said in the press conference afterwards.
It. You've got to love that, man.
You know, you speak to the Italian journalists who are there, and they're like, you know, he wasn't saying it in a disrespectful way. He was trying to show respect for Napoli helping him be where he is. But the Chelsea fans are looking at this Twitter stream thinking, well, you're not going to dedicate it to us, mate. But it's an interesting one.
Well, would you dedicate it to somebody who have been on your backs? I mean, and it's the same with the British media. He's
terrible.
Had such
terrible.
A rough ride. I mean, they finished third, game to spare, qualifying, two games to spare. I mean, mostly because everybody else fell away. But still, a cup final that they probably would have won if he'd been able to make the change that he wasn't allowed to by his own goalkeeper. Wins the Europa League. I mean, he's had a heck of a season, to be fair. He signed one outfield player.
Yeah.
So, to be honest, I mean, it was a silly thing to say, but it's probably a language barrier and a cultural misunderstanding. But I think he is within his rights to kind of say, do you know what, I'm done with this, although it's a very controversial move, of course, going back to the old lady in Italy.
Getting a lot of stick for that as well.
Yeah, an interesting one. I'm not quite sure if that will work out. Then again, I said that about Antonio Conte at Chelsea, and what did he do? He won the double in his first season at the football club. It is interesting as well. How old do you feel? You may well have Frank Lampard as manager of Chelsea, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, manager of Manchester United. We know about Zizou at Real Madrid. You've got Steven Gerrard, manager of Glasgow Rangers. You just feel old. These are boys, these are guys that we grew up with, for goodness sake.
When Thierry Henry jets in to save Arsenal around October, November time, then you'll be really laughing.
And then I think Arsenal may be relegated if he's been jetted in to try and save Arsenal, that's for sure. But Thierry Henry, I mean, my goodness, that was the poison chalice, that Monaco job.
Terrible, terrible, terrible decision from him to take that job. That was a no-win situation. I mean, he let heart rule head there 100%. And things we've read afterwards, I called it immediately, as much as I love and adore him as a footballer, the way he was, the personality that has, that never struck me as managerial material at all. It was all about him, and that's what made him such a phenomenal player. He was Mr. Arsenal for that period of time. He wasn't the captain, and the years that he was the captain was part of a downward trajectory of the club, but he was never going to suit management, I don't think. And you hear the stories that came out of Monaco, his frustrations at players not being able to do the things that he was capable of. And you need to have a little bit of understanding the difference between someone like Frank Lampard, who's gone in with younger players and an arm round the shoulder. Much of what we've read is that Thierry Henry went into Monaco, a club already on its knees, players already just beaten around the bush by a previous regime that wasn't working, by a club that's not very popular, and then giving them one up, you know, a big rocket to try and get the best out of them was never going to work. I think if any old Arsenal player is going to come back and try and save the club, would be, please, Patrick Vieira.
It's interesting you mentioned about the fact that he couldn't let it go, that he was such a great player. It reminds me of the story, very famous story, Graham Souness at Blackburn Rovers. Dwight York tells it brilliantly about the fact that Graham could never let go the fact that he was such a wonderful footballer. And I've had it since confirmed by Dwight. The story at the time was that Andy Cole and Dwight York signed for Blackburn, both to try and recreate the magic of their 1999 treble winning campaign for Manchester United, of course. And Graham Souness joined in a training session, as apparently was often the case on a Thursday afternoon. And Dwight York megged him. Oh, Graham megged. That for those out there perhaps not in tune with what Meg did, essentially put the ball through Graham Souness's legs. Graham Souness was having none of it. Next time Dwight got it, tackle from behind, ruled Dwight out for 6 weeks.
But it's the same. It was the same with Roy Keane as well. Like, you know, players who are sometimes at the very top of their game, and particularly players like Roy Keane, Graham Souness, massive perfectionists as well. It's quite hard for them, I think, to step into those roles as coaches and managers.
And take a step back.
And take a step back and also think, these guys aren't as good as me. They're not putting in as much effort as I put in. And that's why sometimes they don't succeed as well as managers.
Well, Jose Mourinho, any good as a player?
No.
Sir Alex Ferguson, any good?
Decent.
Fine.
Decent.
But not on a pedigree with the likes of Thierry Henry from a player perspective.
Absolutely
Arsene
not.
Arsene Wenger, any good?
No.
No, if you look down that list, it's a very different mindset, obviously, that you take into a dressing room. I love those sort of stories where you hear about, they're just where you're still better than the person that you're trying to get
well,
the best out
of. Well, here's another one for you, and this won't get back to this man. We've had him on this show a number of times. I didn't quite have the authority to ask him out on this, but John Collins, when he was manager of Hibernian, so I've been told by numerous sources, he would often remind people that he still had a six-pack at training to his players. He would often lift up the top to say, guys, hey, I played in AS Monaco, I played forever, and I had longevity in my career. That's what you boys can do if you listen to me. And he would lift up his shirt.
Well, it's a bit like you before the show today, Chris. You made me and Lomas sit and watch your show reel for half an hour before we came on air.
That is lies, lies, and more lies right there. Listen, guys, it's just ticked around 5 o'clock. Keep a lock right here on Dubai 103.8. Have your say as well, 4001. We're going to be in conversation. Sean O'Shea, the AIK Stockholm first team coach, can't quite believe I'm saying that, but he is the first team coach of AIK Stockholm. He's going to be with us in the next 20 minutes or so. We're also going to be speaking to Declan Taylor, boxing correspondent, because it was only right, given the fact we've looked back in the Europa League final, the UEFA Champions League final last Saturday, an unbelievable result over in Madison Square Garden. Anthony Joshua beaten by a 20-1 long shot, a man who by his own admission loves a curry, loves a Snickers, Andy Ruiz Jr. We'll have all of that and much more between now and 6 o'clock. Stay tuned.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.